Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Jill Kaufman. Time now for the Remembrance Project, the lives of those among us. This is the latest in our series of stories from writer Alyssa Eli about ordinary people who've lived extraordinary lives.
Louis Saltanoff died March 5th, 2013, in Redding, Connecticut. He was 95 years old, a man who cheerfully viewed the world as a place in need of innovation. Lou and his brother were raised over a series of candy and toy stores their parents operated. Learnedness was prized in the immigrant family. His brother became a dentist, and Lou became a mechanical engineer with an unabashed sweet tooth. He designed the Atlas launch system for Mercury astronauts and the monorail for the 1964 World's Fair. On his own time, he designed for himself. One of his last concepts, maybe inspired by the candy store beginnings, was a series of drawings for an invention that could distribute mix-ins evenly through pints of ice cream. Sadly, Ben and Jerry's did not purchase it. Happily, they gave him a year's worth of free samples. In the Marine Corps, always crafting and engineering, Lou worked on accommodations for amphibious landing craft. Those were years he didn't speak of afterwards, South Pacific and Guadalcanal. During a leave home, his unit was reassigned to Iwo Jima. Most of his men died there. This, too, he did not speak of. He returned to a corporate career in engineering and a passionate career in after-hours inventing at home. His children recall explosive noises rising from the basement while he worked on a paper-making device, a typesetting machine, a minesweeper. The prototypes were always right on the cusp of spectacular patenting. The timing was always seconds from success. Yet Lou never lost his resilience. He believed utterly in his can-opening belt, and so did his family, even when inventiveness led to unforeseen controversy. After the war, he sent one project inquiry to the Soviet Union. "We were on the same side," he explained. Years later, during the Cold War, his engineering firm uncovered the correspondence and relocated his office desk into the hallway in case communist monitoring was necessary. At home, he reveled in corniness and unorthodoxy. "Are you hungry?" someone would ask him, and he would always, always answer, "I'm not hungry, I'm Jewish." At the dinner parties he and his wife hosted, when enough was enough socially, he would disappear into the bathroom and reemerge pointedly in pajamas. And when Amadeus, the movie about Mozart, came out, he was heard to murmur, "Loved the film, hated the music." To the end, though, he was devoted to his family in a traditional way. After he'd begun to fail, after he could no longer remember that he wasn't hungry, he was Jewish, he still expressed fresh joy every day, when he realized that the woman beside him, a most beautiful creation, was his wife.
That's writer Alyssa Eli remembering Lou Saltanoff, who died in March last year in Redding, Connecticut, at the age of 95.
The Remembrance Project airs every Tuesday on Radio Boston. If you'd like to nominate someone to be profiled for the series, you can send an email to remembrance@wbur.org, and you can find more information at radioboston.org.
When Washington announced earlier this month that it would normalize relations with Cuba, it was huge news in the Cuban-American community. Some people welcomed it and called the shift in policy long overdue. Others were furious and condemned it.
Richard Blanco's response is more complicated, more nuanced. He says there's a whole sense of what it means to be Cuban in Miami and what it means to be a Cuban in Cuba. And now we can have a dialogue. Blanco is the son of Cuban immigrants. He grew up in Miami. He now lives in Maine. He read one of his poems at President Obama's second inauguration in 2013. His most recent book is a memoir called The Prince of Los Cucuyos, and he's here to talk about what this historic shift could mean for the Cuban-American community. And Richard Blanco, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Good to be here, Anthony.
So I want to ask you about that quote. There's a whole sense of what it means to be Cuban in Miami and what it means to be Cuban in Cuba. And now we can have a dialogue. Say more about that new dialogue that it sounds like you welcome.
Well, I think part of it, what's happened, and this, of course, goes back into decades and decades, and I grew up on one side of the 90 miles, sort of fascinated by my cousins in Cuba, the black and white photos bottles that would come in, mm-hmm. these stamps from another country, letters and stories. And they, on the other side, as I learned on my first trip to Cuba, were also equally sort of fascinated and mystified by my life and wondering what would their lives be like had their parents left Cuba, and yeah. thinking about my photos in color and all the rest, and driving my Miata and et cetera, et cetera. So what's happened is I think that we've grown up. There's people in Miami that have grown up in Miami, or people that have been in Miami 50 plus years who are Cuban. And then there's people in Cuba who have stayed in Cuba who are Cuban. And how are we going to have a conversation about that? How are we going to sort of unite those experiences and think about them and sort of share those stories and understand people to people, community to community, family to family, what that all meant like. Yeah. And I think there's a great project to be had there in terms of really understanding what was going on behind the sort of semi-transparent wall that exists between
Cuba.
But a wall nonetheless. Yeah. And what I call an emotional embargo, that there hasn't really been, you know, that kind of free thought and information sort of exchange, even from artist to artist. Mm.
I'd love, because you're a poet, you've brought a poem. And just, I think this the first stanza of this poem, Mother Country, is so germane in a way to some of the stuff I wanted to ask you about. And I wonder if I could get you to read that.
Sure. This was the third of the three inaugural poems that I was asked to write. And I'm just sort of asking people to sort of place themselves in my mother's emotional shoes, as I did in this poem on her journey from Cuba. Mother Country. To love a country as if you've lost one. 1968. My mother leaves Cuba for America, a scene I imagine as if standing in her place, one foot inside a plane destined for a country she knew only as a name, a color on a map, or glossy photos from drugstore magazines. Her other foot anchored to the platform of her patria, her hand clutched around one suitcase, taking only what she needs most, hand-colored photographs of her family, her wedding veil, the doorknob of her house, a jar of dirt from her backyard, goodbye letters she won't open for years, the sorrowful drone of engines, one last deep breath of familiar air she'll take with her, one last glimpse at all she'd ever known. The palm trees wave goodbye as she steps onto the plane. The mountains shrink from her eyes as she lifts off into another life.
Hmm. That's Richard Blanco reading a section of his poem, Mother Country. Richard Blanco, it's so beautiful from the first line to the end there. To love a country as if you've lost one. It seems to me with this embargo coming down, normalizing relationships. I mean, does normalization mean that folks can now love a country as if they can return to it now in a way that they couldn't before?
I think so, but I think normalization is a very complex word. Yeah. And I think what the Cuban community and myself included is sort of watching out for what that normalization means.
Sure.
And I think what we're trying not to lose sight of, and what I think we're trying to sort of force the issue on is the idea that ultimately these normalizations, our end goal that I think we can all agree on, every Cuban and every generation and probably most people in the United States, is greater democratic reforms for Cuba and the prosperity of the Cuban people. Mm-hmm. And that's really sort of the nugget of what all this means for us. And I think where you see the resistance or an ambivalence or a contradiction or in some ways a resentment is, what does that normalization mean? And if normalization means just because people want to travel to Cuba and sip mojito-flavored lattes on your malecón, that's not the goal.
And I don't think
that's the administration's goal. I think our administration, our president, must be pretty wise to know what's the real situation in Cuba. But I think the general public sort of has this mystified, over-romanticized sense of Cuba and doesn't really see the reality of what this long emotional history of what this embargo means and U.S.-Cuban relations, which go back back almost 200 years that have always been complex and mystified and romanticized.
Yeah, is there a sense? I mean, it seems like the average American probably thinks of Cuban-American relationships as existing only within that bubble of this, Cold War reality. But as you suggest, there's a history that precedes that.
And also that that Cold War, where the embargo was begun, and in that Cold War history in those days, the embargo and what it meant has also sort of evolved and transformed. Mm-hmm. And it's become more of almost just a glue, a thing of principle that said to the community that, that everything will be okay because we are together unified in the sense of naming what we need to name what it is. And so that's part of where it's transformed. And it's no longer really sort of, it's transformed from this Cold War sort of ideological sort of standoff to more of something. It's interesting because when I went to Miami right after the news, there's a reluctance to even speak about this.
Really? I want to ask you, I mean, were people in the streets? Was everybody talking about it?
It was like, I was walking around going like, hello, did anybody hear the news? I was expecting people shouting on both ends of the spectrum. In between, I could barely pull words out of my mother, and all she could say was, we'll see.
Really?
We'll see. And the same with the other
family
relatives.
And what explains that? Is it just that it's impossible to believe, so we'll see? I mean, it's been so long.
What it is, it caught me by surprise because I realized I was sort of in a same sort of ambivalent space. It was that whether you were for normalizing or not, we had built our lives around this paradigm of thinking that change is never going to happen.
Sure.
So it was almost like this sort of almost like a death in the family, almost like something you're so used to or something that's been around you all your life, this paradigm, that suddenly there was potential that this was going to change. And I think there's a little bit of shock. There's a little bit of mourning. There's a little bit of, wait, what does change look like now? I mean, a little bit of confusion. And I think that in general, of course, in the media, you see the more of the more boisterous people and whatnot. But in general, everybody was going about their Christmas shopping as if nothing. Yeah. That's what I was able to see.
Interesting. So that's the reaction of Cuban Americans. You wrote something interesting on NPR. You reviewed a book called The Havana Habit for NPR recently. And in that, you wrote that you have a problem with people, and I assume you're referring to non-Cuban Americans who are saying, I'm dying to go to Cuba before it changes.
Yes. I don't think I'm the only one. I got to tell you, it's one of the pet peeve questions of most Cuban Americans and most Cubans. And I understand where people are coming from. I understand, that they want to see Cuba before it potentially gets over-commercialized and turns into some tourist, overrun city and whatnot. But it lacks a little bit of sensitivity, and I think when people say that, if they don't qualify that question, I think it lacks a little bit of information. They're missing a little bit of information because it's the equivalent of saying in some ways, I want to go to North Korea before it changes, So the idea is that Cuba could benefit from change, and this is obviously the door that the president has opened, correct? That there is need and real need for change, of course, managed change. And I think to the benefit of those that ask that question, and my hope, folds into this, is that those changes are in the end controlled, affected, and put into place by the Cuban people. That there isn't this sort of swooping down on Havana and Cuba of outside commercial interests and ownership, which, if my history serves me correctly, was part of the reason why the revolution started in the first place. So
I think you're right.
Here we go again.
Right. So do you have plans to be heading back to Cuba soon?
Well, I was just planning a trip the day before the news. I was planning sort of a cultural trip to meet some writers and finally start having some kind of dialogue because I felt that we needed to start talking about and sharing stories, if anything, just for the sake of the art and understanding, each other at an emotional level and sort of lifting that emotional embargo, as I call it. And then the news broke. So now I think it's that trip is going to be pushed forward, in part because now it doesn't seem like it would have to be so clandestine. Now I feel like there's a different spirit and a different note on which I could go.
Well, it's a new day. However it turns out, and let's hope for the best, certainly a new day in Cuban-American relations. Richard Blanco, thank you for coming in to talk about it. I'm very grateful.
My pleasure.
That's Richard Blanco, Cuban-American poet. His most recent book is a memoir called The Princess of Los Cucuyos. Thanks again, Richard.
Thank you.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Jill Kaufman.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.